This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My name is Alan Scott. This is the place where government actions meet business decisions. Online at www.bgov.com. And, of course, on the air right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, Thursdays at 11 and Fridays at 2:30. It's the Year in Review edition as we take a look this time around at the world of energy. What happened in 2012, and what do we have to look forward to in 2013? And we'd be remiss if we didn't bring back someone who's no stranger to the program, energy analyst Mr. Rob Barnett. How are you, Rob?
Doing just fine. Pleasure to be here this week.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, the year had ups and downs with regard to energy, the ups being, I should say, the downs or the lows being gas prices, natural gas prices, that is, hitting an all-time low, decade low, let's say, and a high. Dare I say, have we reached energy independence? Is that possible?
Well, we haven't reached it, but there's certainly a lot of people talking about it right here in D.C. right now. So natural gas prices are at an all-time low. Natural gas production is at an all-time high.
Yep.
So we have this new resource in the country. At the same time, oil production is surging over the last few years in the United States. Over the last 2 years, oil production has increased by 16%. I mean, we are seeing a renaissance in terms of oil and gas production in the U.S. It is all because of fracking, as you may have heard it. The industry calls it hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling, but it's basically applying new technology to oil and gas production, which has been able to increase the volumes at which we can produce in this country.
Gas prices, and I'm talking about fuel prices for vehicles now, fluctuated so much over the year. Lately now, getting towards the end of the year, things seem to be dropping. Could the hydraulic fracturing have something to do with this? I mean, prices tend to rise and fall, ebb and flow throughout the year, with no real reason behind it, if you ask me.
Well, that's because we're subject to a global market. So, you know, oil prices have swung up and down, and consequently, gasoline prices have done so as well. So we are basically ending the year roughly where we started, about $3.30 a gallon nationally. But we hit $4 a gallon twice over the course of the year. So we kind of up, down, and that is the whim of the global oil market, frankly. But I'll tell you this much. Right now, families taking vacations, things like that, you're able to save about $10 each time you fill up compared with some of the points earlier this year.
Yeah.
So there is a real savings that folks are realizing. Also, there's no consistency for planning, though.
This is very true. Very true. You get down there, you saved $10, and on the way back, oh my gosh, it's $30 more just to make it back home. I guess depending on where you are regionally, you're going to find fluctuations in prices as well.
That's right. There's a big regional variation in gasoline across the country. Some of the lowest prices are in the Southeast.
Yeah. Gotta love the Southeast.
Absolutely.
So I made some little notes here on the article that you and Sandy Reback have written. One of them says, gas prices plus regulations equals shift. Equals shift in electric generation away from coal towards natural gas. And you guys put together a cool study about that, the twilight of coal-fired power. Tell me about it.
Right. So, as you have already mentioned, natural gas prices reached a decade low this
mm-hmm.
year. In the electric power sector, natural gas and coal are really fierce competitors. So the balance sort of shifts between those two fuels. And with low natural gas prices, we've really seen natural gas take market share from coal. In addition to that, there are a lot of new EPA regulations that essentially you could think of them as adding cost to coal-fired electric power. So when you think about the double whammy of low natural gas prices and a whole portfolio of new EPA regulations,
right,
it's become a more difficult place to operate coal. And consequently, we've seen a big surge in the share that natural gas takes for electric power generation.
Let's talk about becoming an energy exporter. Is there any wiggle room in this area as we discuss the regulations and such? Yeah, it's going to cost more. It's going to take more time. Can we make some of that back by exporting it?
Well, actually, we already export a fair amount of coal from the United States. Mm-hmm. So as natural gas has taken market share from coal and electric power, we've actually seen exports rise. So the producers haven't been as hard hit as you might have thought based on what's happened to domestic demand for coal. There's also a lot of talk about exporting natural gas right now. So there are a couple of government agencies, DOE and FERC, Department of Energy, and Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, that weigh in on whether we can export natural gas via liquefied natural gas.
Oh,
so
nice.
Big controversy right now about whether we're going to do that or not. But I'll remind the listeners here, you only have to go back 5 years or so, and there was a time period when most of the folks following the energy space would have said we were going to be importing a lot of natural gas. And so that really speaks to the power of this fracking and shale gas revolution that we've seen here in the United States. So we've gone from a conversation about importing LNG to exporting LNG, and the government really is the stakeholder that's got to approve these facilities to do that or not, and we're in a kind of a holding pattern to see whether they're going to do that or not right now.
Let's talk a little bit about the EPA. A pretty big setback in 2012. Explain what happened, where we're going to go from there. What's next for the EPA with regard to this whole natural gas and air pollution and such?
Yeah, so EPA had a very active year in 2012. Mm-hmm. They put forward new regulations on everything from automobiles to coal plants. And so, you know, I think a lot of the big industrial companies in the U.S. are feeling the pressure of EPA more than they've ever felt it, and they've got a lot of new regulations that they're dealing with. That being said, it hasn't been a slam dunk for EPA on all the regulations that it's been putting forward. They lost some important court battles, had some rules overturned related to sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides. At the same time, they got a thumbs up from the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals on their new greenhouse gas regulations. So it's sort of a mixed bag in terms of looking at what EPA's been up to. But I can tell you that they've got a pretty full agenda, and there's a lot that we'd expect to see coming down the pipe here in 2013 from EPA.
You mentioned something as we discussed the EPA, and you mentioned automobiles. Where are we with the development of an automobile that can get about 1,000 miles to a gallon? I mean, I know the EPA has said, you know what, we've got standards, and by X year, we want your vehicles to be able to achieve a certain goal. Where are we in that process right now?
Yeah, well, wouldn't it be great to have a car that got 1,000 miles
amazing,
per gallon?
Amazing, amazing.
We all look forward to that day, I think. You know,
where do I put a comment in for that?
Well, you know, I mean, there are a number of cars that are kind of lab demonstration kind of things that can actually go pretty far on a gallon. Mm-hmm. In reality, the Toyota Prius here in the U.S. still holds the lead in terms of MPG. It gets about 55 miles per gallon, or at least that's what it's rated to get.
Right.
Doesn't actually get that in real-world driving conditions, I don't think. Whereas, you know, most cars, you see this sticker, and you can usually discount it a little bit in terms of what you'll actually achieve on the road. Right now, the average new car being sold in the U.S. gets right around 30 miles per gallon, and over time, according to the EPA rules that came out in 2012, the automobile manufacturers have to get that number up to a little over 50 miles per gallon.
Okay.
So, you know, it's kind of like everyone in the future has to get a car that's going to get the equivalent of what a Prius gets today. Not to say that every car has to get that, because the industry gets the average across all of the vehicles it sells. So some will get more, some will get less. You know, there's been a big movement. And, you know, oil prices, gasoline prices have actually helped be a part of that shift. You know, gasoline basically is at the highest level it's ever been in the U.S.,
sure.
You know, touching on $4 a gallon this year. And so as consumers have actually gone out and bought vehicles, they've bought smaller vehicles, more efficient vehicles, vehicles that have better fuel economy.
Yeah, I am in the market for a new vehicle now, and seriously considering, of all things, a truck that burns irreplaceable fossil fuel like no tomorrow. However, I have seen there's some technology with some of the companies out there that turns that V8 or V6 into a four-cylinder and helps it burn less fuel. So they are mindful of the fact that the fuel is obviously expensive, and people need to factor that in. And I noticed on a lot of the stickers, it tells you about how much fuel you're going to spend, how much money you're going to spend on average for fuel for that vehicle for a year. Astronomical amount when you sit back and think about it. So I really want to get a truck. Why? You look at me like you're crazy.
It's the American way.
It's the American way,
you
exactly.
You have to have a big car in the
Everybody
United
has
States.
To have a big car. You know, I drive a minivan, okay? But I'm going to keep the minivan for the family and such. But the truck, I like to go to the landfill and just throw stuff off the back of it. And it's just a weekend driver, you know, nothing bad. Is that bad?
Well, I mean, you know, that's you're dealing with choice, and that's actually how the rules are designed from EPA. I mean, they try to increase fuel economy on average without limiting choice, and
right.
So if you actually look into the weeds of the standards, basically, if preferences are such that people like to drive bigger cars. Don't have to get quite the same fuel economy that smaller cars. So it's actually based on sort of the quote-unquote footprint of the vehicle. So the vehicle size determines what the actual fuel economy is going to be based on the standards.
Right. I'll be saving fuel while I'm running over people. Not actual people, though. But like, you know, smile as you go under. That's all I'm saying.
Sure.
Let's talk about wind, wind facilities and such. There's been kind of a renaissance, so to speak. I mean, I'd never really thought I'd say, hey, look, there's a whole bank of windmills here generating power. Where are we with the development of more wind generators, so to speak?
Yeah, so 2012 is shaping up to be a pretty good year for wind power plant additions in the United States. We've seen wind grow from almost nothing a decade ago, and it's generating a few percent of electricity right now. Yeah. So it's still a very much a niche technology, but it's been growing very fast. 2012 has been an interesting year just because an important government tax credit, you might hear it called the Wind Production Tax Credit, it expires at the end of the year. So you've actually seen a rush by developers to try and get a lot of new facilities completed during 2012 so they can take advantage of that tax credit. 2013 might be a much drier year for wind in terms of new projects unless the government decides to re-up this tax credit. And there's discussions about that. It all comes down. It'll be part of the fiscal cliff, these kinds of discussions and general things about tax reform as to whether that'll actually get renewed or not. It's one of these subsidies and tax things out there that big businesses take advantage of, and I think the country has in many ways kind of been moving against things like that, so it'll be interesting to see if there's a carve out for that particular credit or not.
Typically see them out in mountainous areas. I've never really seen any in a residential setting, but one thing that you do see before we get into what 2013 holds for energy, one thing that I'm starting to see almost a resurgence of, and it seems so 80s to me, solar power. I'm starting to see more and more people putting solar things on the roofs of their houses. Is that something I would imagine you can take yourself off the grid, so to speak, with this solar power? Is this as big as it was years ago?
Yeah, I think solar power has really undergone a lot of transformation. I mean, the price to put solar on your roof is dramatically lower this year than even 2 or 3 years ago. I mean,
really?
We are talking about multi-digit declines in prices every year. So it's had a very good cost decline curve as the technology's gotten better. And we've also seen a lot of low-cost Chinese manufacturer come in and drive down the price. And so we're actually seeing a lot of markets in the U.S. where folks are putting it on their roofs, and even you'll see larger companies putting, Walmart to this world, kind of putting it on their roofs and things like that. So it's something that's out there. The costs aren't quite in the money yet still in most markets. It kind of depends on what your local power prices are.
Right.
So in some places it makes sense, in some places it doesn't. There are a number of tax credits out there that don't expire this year. They've got a few more years left that really help put solar in the money from a sort of economic perspective.
Right.
But without those tax credits, I don't think we'd see it as pervasive as we are seeing it right now. And certainly the cost decline curve looks good for solar, so I think we're going to see more of it in the future. It's just a question of Now, where do prices for other fuels go, and where does its price ultimately settle out?
Sure. Let's take a look into your by the way, you're listening to Federal News Radio. This is Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact. We're speaking with Rob Barnett, energy analyst, who has co-authored a piece called BGov 2012 Review and 2013 Outlook in the World of Energy. And I want you to look into your BGov crystal ball now. It's 2013. The smoke clears. What are we seeing in the world of energy?
I don't think we're going to see a lot of major policy revisions on energy in 2013 or 2014. Congress isn't exactly a body that functions that well, in my view. So getting a consensus to pass any bill is quite difficult. Energy is a particularly divisive issue, so I'd be surprised if we saw what I would describe as major energy legislation. So if you think about the world where you are unlikely to get anything big on energy from Congress, that really kicks things to the executive branch and then to state and local government. So I think President Obama will try to do as much as he can on energy, but he's going to be doing it through agency rulemakings and executive order as opposed to having a bill he can sign. And I think EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, is going to be one of the major agencies that really is shaping U.S. energy policy. We've got new ozone standards that we'd expect to be coming, new standards related to water, and other types of emissions, greenhouse gases. So EPA's got a pretty full agenda, and they're really going to be driving probably a set of new rules that will continue to make it increasingly difficult to operate coal and even some other and to use possibly other types of fossil fuels here in the U.S.
How likely do you think it'll be that the president, who now is in his final term, obviously, and has the ability to, you know what, let me just sign this. You know what, people are asking for it. I want to do it. You guys can't decide on it, so I'm just going to make it so. How likely is that going to happen with maybe something he's passionate about?
Yeah, I mean, I think you see, you know, that kind of wishful thinking perhaps with maybe the issue of climate change. And the environmental groups would love to see the U.S. really have a firm policy on the topic. And unfortunately, it's not a topic that the president can, you know, really solve via executive order.
Right.
You know, there's a patchwork of regulations that are coming through EPA to tackle the topic, but none of them solve the issue in the way that a legislative version of policy could, and EPA's toolkit is quite constrained because,
right,
you know, you really have to operate within the confines of existing law, and there's only so much that EPA and other agencies can really do and still not cross that line. And so you're seeing a sort of interesting policy outcome. I'd describe it as a patchwork instead of something comprehensive.
Without someone sitting down and paving the way or repaving the way, I'd say, it's a little difficult for the president just to sign away on something and say, make it so, number one. Oh, wait, I am number one. He's not.
Exactly.
Exactly.
So, I mean, you know, I think he'll probably do stuff that will try to push the needle on greenhouse gases. And
right,
I think so far he's also stayed more or less out of the way of the oil and gas renaissance that's been occurring here in the country. So you could argue he could be way more obstructionist than he has been. And so we're seeing a lot of increased oil and gas production.
Mm-hmm.
Most people would think that that's a pretty good thing. And, you know, from an energy standpoint, at least he hasn't got in and really tried to derail that in any
sure
way through any type of policy.
Good point. Good point. His name is Rob Barnett. He's an energy analyst with Bloomberg Government. See his works at www.bgov.com. Looking forward to an exciting 2013, Rob.
Me too.
Thanks for stopping by.
Thanks.
Earlier this year, Rob Barnett had an opportunity to sit down with Mr. T. Boone Pickens. Don't know who he is? Well, Forbes magazine has him on their list of the world's richest people, now 8 years running. And he's also a big proponent of expanded natural gas drilling. Here's how it sounded.
For those who aren't familiar, maybe it'd be good for you to give a quick overview of Pickens' plan, maybe some highlights, and then would love to just kind of chat about some of the politics around energy.
Okay. In 2008, July of 2008, I decided that I had never served in the military, and the Pickens have. for clear back to General Andrew Pickens in the Revolutionary War. But my timing was a little off. In World War II, I was a little bit young. The Korean War was my war, and I was married and had a child. And then I was too old for the Vietnam War. I thought, you know, sometime I'm going to get a mission. And so as it unfolded, we need desperately, this country does, to have an energy plan. We've got plenty of resources, and we don't know how. One, we don't even have a good inventory of them. And two, we don't have anybody in Washington that understands them that can get up and talk about energy longer than 3 or 4 minutes. And so I thought, I'll do this. And I, right at that point, I've been rich several times. And at that point, I was at a high water mark on rich. And so I spent $100 million to explain an energy plan to America and come up, you know, with what I thought was a solution to something we had never had. Can you imagine we use more energy than any country in the world? With 5% of the population, we're using over 20% of the energy. And we don't have an energy plan. We're the only country in the world without an energy plan. So anyway, I thought, this is my mission. And so I did. I've been working on it. And now I've gotten kind of fed up with it because I can't get anything done in Washington. And I had the Natural Gas Act in place to go, and we finally got a vote on it over in the Senate, but they made it non-germane to the bill they were going to put the Natural Gas Act on. The bill was a transportation bill. Okay. And what I'm selling is a Natural Gas Act, which is natural gas for heavy-duty trucks. Do you not think that would fit on a transportation bill and would be, you know, deemed germane? It wasn't. It was non-germane, so now I have to have 60 votes instead of 51. Well, I got 51. We got 51 to 47, but it didn't get on the transportation bill, so it didn't pass. And I'm kind of, I've got other things to do, and I'm running out of time. So I decided at 84, if they want to pass the bill, I'll help every way I can, all for the right reasons. It'd be good for our country if we did it. But if they don't pass it, that natural gas is moving into the heavy-duty trucks anyway. So it's going to take twice as long, probably 5 or 6 years. You could probably do it in 3 or 4 years. If they pass the Natural Gas Act. And it was no cost to taxpayers.
So with the Nat Gas Act, it would have provided some subsidies and incentives for infrastructure and vehicles and whatnot. So what's that right balance between government kind of pushing and pulling in a particular direction and having complete hands-off laissez-faire on energy?
Let me clarify that. It had a tax credit in it, and it was a pay-for. The pay-for, user pay, like a toll road. If you use the natural gas, you paid the taxes. And it completely covered it. Listen, anytime you can sell Senator Tom Coburn that it's got a pay-for, he won't pay for a damn thing. I don't care. He wouldn't pay a dime to see a piss ant eat a bale of hay. And so he told me, and he's a friend of mine.
Rob Barnett with Mr. T. Boone Pickens at the Republican National Convention. And that puts the wraps on yet another edition of Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact. Make sure you follow us on Twitter at BGov, and you can follow me at Alan L. Scott for show updates. We'll be back next Thursday at 11. We've got plenty more to say about the business impact of government actions. For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, I'm Alan Scott.